Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European news podcast, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge with our weekly combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Find Inside Europe wherever you get your podcasts.
A journalist from the Philippines has a warning for the U.S.
We watched our history change in front of our eyes.
Now she says she has deja vu. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, Nobel Prize winner Maria Ressa joins the show to talk about the rise of autocracy in the Philippines and beyond. And new research shows how birch trees may be communicating.
Nothing happens in nature unless it's really necessary.
In Austria, a Porsche mogul wants to dig a tunnel under a historic 17th century villa.
He does it because he can, because he has the money to do it.
And our reporter takes us to a rave.
It's so loud, your whole body becomes like one giant ear. Your chest, a subwoofer.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2021 for the risks she took as a journalist in the Philippines under former dictator Rodrigo Duterte. Maria Ressa was sentenced to almost 7 years in prison for reporting the truth. In 2022, she published a book called How to Stand Up to a Dictator. Today, she joined me in studio.
Checks and balances of institutions depend on the men and women who will carry those out.
We'll hear that conversation with Maria Ressa later in the show. But first, let's turn our attention to the Vatican. The work to choose a new pope begins next week with the papal conclave,
where they will begin one of the world's oldest and most secretive electoral processes.
Voting cardinals enter the Sistine Chapel, where each will take an oath of secrecy. The penalty, automatic excommunication.
In addition to leading the world's Catholics, Pope Francis's successor will have to oversee the church's complex financial institutions. Francis began his papacy determined to root out corruption in them, but was only partially successful. Massimo Fagioli teaches theology and religious studies at Villanova University.
Traditionally, the most important Vatican institution dealing with finance is the Istituto Opere di Religione, which is usually called Vatican Bank.
Vatican Bank.
Right, which has been touched by a series of scandals in his entire life. And one of the things that happened under Pope Francis was the effort to clean up some accounts who shouldn't be part of the Vatican financial system.
I understand that the bank, correct me if I'm wrong here, had been linked at some point to organized crime and the Nazis. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, certainly what emerged in these last few years were investors that were connected to industries that are really not compatible with the mission of the church, like the arms industry, weapons trade, and in general also some other accounts that used the Vatican Bank as a way to stay away from other banking systems that were subject to more controls by authorities.
So when he became Pope back in 2013, Pope Francis set out to root out corruption in the Vatican's financial institutions. What kind of changes did he try to make in the Vatican Bank?
Well, the first thing Pope Francis said on the Vatican Bank said something like, I don't think St. Peter had a bank. And that rattled the nerves of many people. And so clearly that was just the beginning. And two different factors influenced Pope Francis' action. One was the perception that in the Vatican Bank still there were accounts that were really unseemly.
Unseemly?
Well, it's embarrassing to have some accounts there. So it was a problem of reputation. And then the second problem, which was not simple to solve, was how to make sure that the Vatican doesn't become a safe haven for people who want to engage in tax avoidance, like some banks offshore in the Cayman Islands, something like that.
He was trying to sever ties with organizations that might not align with the Vatican's values, let's say, and also make sure the bank was not able to be used as a tax haven.
Right.
How successful was Pope Francis in those efforts?
It was successful up to a point. So his action was in two ways. One, to pass new laws, to change some structures, but also he appointed some special people who were really different from the pre-existing Italian-dominated elite, especially a cardinal from Australia, Cardinal George Pell, who was really part of an Anglo-Saxon culture of transparency, accountability. The relations of Cardinal Pell with the rest of the Roman Curia were very difficult, to put it politely. It's not clear how that effort succeeded or not. So it's also part of the cultural change that needs to happen, changing some personnel. And Pope Francis did really the bold move, I mean, antagonizing some of the pre-existing officers, also bringing in some lay experts from the international banking system, and their tenure was usually interrupted. So on that front, it was a partially successful effort.
Mm. So what is the biggest financial issue that the next pope will have to tackle?
Well, in these last few years, we know that the Vatican is running a very significant deficit every year. So there's a problem of diminishing donations coming from traditionally Catholic countries because they are becoming more secular, or donations that come with strings attached. But mostly because this is really now with Pope Francis, this is clear, this is a global church, which means also made of churches that have more needs, that are poorer, that have more emergencies, and the Vatican needs to help more. So this is no longer the Catholic Church or the Vatican of the 19th century, which was dominated by the European, all Catholic, German, Belgian, French. This is now more diverse, but also the demographic shift is turning towards the global south, which is made of poor countries, and that means more needs for the Vatican and fewer resources.
Massimo Pajoli teaches theology and religious studies at Villanova University. 50 years after the Vietnam War ended, some of the scars it left have healed, but not all of them. The chemical Agent Orange dropped from U.S. planes to eradicate jungles has proven notoriously hard to remove from Vietnam soil, even though the U.S. has spent decades trying. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, there's another wartime chemical getting much less attention, even though it is still making people in Vietnam sick.
Kenneth Olson served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War, but never deployed there. He always wanted to see the country, though. Or better yet, to crawl through those famous tunnels dug by communist fighters outside Ho Chi Minh City. So in 2016, he went on a tunnel tour.
I didn't go very far. I'm a little bit claustrophobic.
Emerging back into the daylight, something caught his eye.
When I crawled out, I looked and the trees were all slender and dwarfed, and I kind of wondered why.
Olson is trained to notice foliage. He's an agronomist, a soil expert, and professor emeritus at the University of Illinois. Olson was struck by the sheer persistence of toxic defoliants dumped by the U.S. on Vietnam's lush jungles decades ago. He started looking into all the chemicals used back then and realized Agent Orange, that's only half the story. A lumbering C-123 cargo plane dumping thousands of gallons of chemicals over South Vietnam, as captured in the mid-1960s by a TV news crew. An officer on board explains the mission.
We have a lot of areas where the enemy are hiding under this canopy of trees, and our job is to defoliate so that the enemy is not able to hide from our forward air controllers that go around looking for the enemy.
To wipe out heavy foliage, they dumped Agent Orange. But what if U.S. forces wanted to poison crops so the communists couldn't eat? Olson says that called for a different chemical, Agent Blue.
Agent Blue was designed to kill the rice. It was arsenic-based. And the problem with arsenic is it doesn't have a half-life.
Agent Blue wasn't actually blue. It was clear and odorless, but it came in a steel drum marked by a blue ring. It was about one-third arsenic, a stubborn chemical that sticks around for decades in soil, stunting trees, and polluting groundwater.
And remember, the water often gets mixed in with the food supply, right? Shrimp, fish, rice.
All staples of a rural Vietnamese dinner, then and now. Injuries from arsenic are insidious. The chemical slowly builds up in the body, causing skin cancer, lesions, and heart disease.
I calculated how much pure arsenic was sprayed in South Vietnam. I came up with over 1 million kilograms. That's over 2 million pounds of pure arsenic.
Olson has become one of the foremost Agent Blue researchers, working with Vietnamese academics and publishing findings in peer-reviewed journals. But their work is overshadowed by Agent Orange. Its infamy comes from tragic effects on kids. Even if someone is exposed to Agent Orange residue today, their kids can have severe birth defects.
We now have a fourth generation of Agent Orange victims in Vietnam.
Phan Xuân Dung is a Vietnamese researcher with the ISEAS Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore.
There were other agents, like Agent Blue and White and Pink. Agent Orange was just one of them, but it was the most widely used. So it remains the biggest problem.
There are two major anniversaries this year in Vietnam. It's been 50 years since Vietnam's reunification, and also 30 years since Vietnam and America normalized relations. Since then, the U.S. has spent nearly $500 million decontaminating Agent Orange sites, cleaning out dioxin, its most toxic ingredient. Phan says this work is the foundation of U.S.-Vietnam relations. It allows leaders to say, look, the Americans are trying to make things right.
From the Vietnamese government's perspective, Agent Orange is a chemical weapon, and the use of Agent Orange was a war crime.
America's Agent Orange cleanup projects are now up in the air as part of the Trump administration's cuts and freezes to foreign aid, refocusing on domestic problems.
If the U.S. walks away, it sends a very bad message to Vietnam. It will further reinforce Vietnam's idea that the U.S. is not a really reliable partner.
This comes at a time when the work of Professor Kenneth Olson and others indicates the aftermath of chemical dumping is actually worse than many believe. There are no U.S.-backed cleanup programs for Agent Blue, and a recent independent study is pretty alarming. It shows that in certain Vietnamese villages, arsenic levels in groundwater are through the roof, and that roughly 1 in 80 deaths each year in Vietnam can be attributed to arsenic exposure. Olson says in rural Agent Blue hotspots, Vietnamese families are at severe risk.
It's not like you're a veteran and you're there 1 year and you're gone. These people are still living there. They're still eating it. It's still getting in the food supply.
There are potential solutions: improving water treatment plants, cleaning arsenic out of crop soil, even cheap filters that families can use for drinking water. But Olson says, for now, Agent Blue remediation is a distant priority. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Picture this, if you would. Four guys in a band, up front, guitar, bass, and vocals. The drummer's in the back. They're dressed up in black suits with black ties, bobbing their heads to a rock beat. They sound like this. The band is called Hoa. They're from Seoul, and they consider their sound indie rock. You could call them the Korean Beatles. Lots of other people have, but they wouldn't necessarily like that. Even though their Beatles sound is intentional, the video for this tune, I Don't Know Why, in black and white, conjures the Fab Four's debut on The Ed Sullivan Show. Just as the Beatles' sound evolved over the years, Hoa's has along similar lines, giving fans a bit of retro in a country where K-pop rules.
Bushman.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Trees can communicate with each other. That is established by scientists. New research suggests that the electrical signals in birch trees in Italy varied before a solar eclipse in a way that might have helped the forest prepare. Alessandro Chiole-Rio, a scientist at the Italian Institute of Technology, led that research.
So what we did is we built a portal for listening the voices of the plants. This is a metaphor, of course. We are not recording audio signals, but rather electrical signals.
And what did you learn about these electrical signals that traveled through these birch trees?
We discovered that those signals are synchronized. It's more or less like listening to the music coming from an orchestra, no? Where all the instruments play in synchronicity, so that you hear a melody that is harmonic. But some other times, things happen and this harmony is disrupted. So we discovered that the solar eclipse is disrupting the synchronicity of the electrical signals in the forest.
So the solar eclipse makes these trees go out of sync with the electrical signals that are flowing through their barks.
Exactly.
So is this change in electrical activity signals among the trees to each other that, you know, there is a solar eclipse coming, don't worry, the sun will come back?
So we have analyzed trees as old as 70 years. They should have witnessed other eclipses in their past.
Okay.
So what could happen actually is that the older trees could have signaled to the younger trees what was going on.
And why would it be important for them to send that signal?
To create a situation of protection. So, for example, there are other researches that have shown that this happens with the chemicals, like volatile compounds, when, for example, a fire takes place in a forest. So those plants that are affected by the fire communicate to the others through these chemical volatiles that the danger is coming.
Right.
In that case, what they can do is to pump water from the soil and therefore use the probability of being burnt and killed by the fire. Similarly, there could be, but we didn't observe this, I suppose there could be a similar mechanism for what concerns the solar eclipse, like a protection.
Interesting. Can you describe what the bioelectricity, what the electricity flow is doing in these trees?
So what happens is that, for example, the plant is involved in internal processes. There is a lymph flow that's coming down and up and down. So upwards in the external part of the trunk and inwards in the internal part of the trunk. And this flow brings ions, which are electrically charged particles. So they create the currents that we measure externally with our electrodes. And any tiny variation of this flow can be traced indirectly by using our electrical measurements.
So basically there's electricity flowing through trees just like there is electricity flowing through the human body.
Definitely. It also depends very much on the amount of water that is present in the soil. Because for example, it rained one day and the soil is totally soaked in water, then this creates an additional voltage drop that builds up on top of what we measure. So we must also be able to adapt to this. When the soil is dry, totally dry, for example, this voltage goes down. It's like more or less every tree is like a battery.
Alessandro Chiole-Rio is a scientist at the Italian Institute of Technology. Sales of tarot cards are up in many countries, according to market research. We reached out to Mary Kay Greer, the author of Tarot for Yourself, to talk about why.
With everything changing so quickly, there's a lot of uncertainty. People are concerned about their jobs, their livelihood. So everybody is in a state of maximum uncertainty, and that's when tarot rules.
So just for those who might not be familiar, how does a reading work? Can you give us the quick sum up?
Usually somebody comes with a question, although it may just be what's going to happen for me over the next couple of months. And then the reader will pull a certain number of cards, depending on the amount of time that you have, and the question itself, what's spread, because you lay them out in a particular pattern, you know, whether it's the past, present, or future is the simplest three-card spread, for instance. So in a 15-minute reading, you might have anywhere from 3 to 10 cards, and the reader will interpret those in terms of the question, the person that's there with them, unless you're doing it by email. But it's primarily looking for the metaphors in the symbols of the cards as relates to the person.
Mary, I want to get into the history here and how these cards have spread around the world. They go back to Renaissance Italy, but at first they were used for a game.
Yes, there were a lot of games, very similar to bridge. And the first decks we have are from the courts, so they're these beautiful hand-painted gold-encrusted decks.
The royal courts.
Yeah, the royal courts of northern Italy.
And how did they spread from Italy into other parts of Europe?
Well, the French came in and conquered primarily Milan, and that was probably the center of where the tarot cards emerged. So the French took them into France, and they became very popular as woodcut decks.
Like woodcut block prints?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So in that case, they spread to the military. You know, men in encampments would be, or their women cooks and cleaners. They would go out to fight, and the women who were doing the cooking and the cleaning back at the camp would be going, is he coming back? And we actually have a painting from the French Revolution showing that exact scene.
Huh. So it sounds like at some point in the history we just covered, the tarot cards shifted from being a game to closer to what they are today. At what point was that shift made?
It was very slow over time, and we see, you know, little hints, but very little document of it at first. It was also used occasionally for wish fulfillment. So there's some court records where somebody wanted someone to come back to them, and they used certain cards to try and entice someone back. So all of these things kind of merged at some point by the end of the 18th century into the kind of readings that we do today.
We've been talking about Europe, but now tarot cards are popular all around the world, or at least in many countries around the world. Is there a sense of where they are most popular or where they are catching on quicker than others?
They've got tarot cafes in South Korea. Japan has integrated it with their anime stories. But also you find more and more of an interest, like I'm finding this in China, in more therapeutic approach to tarot.
That kind of gets to this idea of some people using them not because they believe that they'll tell them anything about the future, but as a, you know, more of a self-reflection or introspection tool.
Exactly. And my favorite statement for what tarot's purpose is that it helps you meet whatever comes in the best possible way by getting more insight and finding a sense of meaning to the things that are happening to you and the possibilities of future direction, of course, but not as a fixed thing.
Mary Kay Greer is the author of Tarot for Yourself. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Maria Ressa is the co-founder of the Filipino investigative news site Rappler. And when she looks at America, she sees something familiar.
Can I laugh and just say I have both deja vu and PTSD?
Ressa spent much of her career working as a journalist in the Philippines. She was arrested several times during the reign of the authoritarian leader Rodrigo Duterte. When she came by our studio today, I asked her to describe what aspects of her experience might help people understand how a free press can come under attack. She brought up an incident from her early days running a newsroom under Duterte.
2018 was when the government first tried to shut us down. And I was so naive that I called a press conference without telling my lawyers. And they reminded me, by the way, but you know, we were right because fear plays a role. And what I've learned through the 6 years of Rodrigo Duterte is you have to hold the line. You have to fight for your rights because every day you do not, you lose more. So they tried to shut us down in 2018, 2019, the arrest. And that to me is when I shifted. I had 10 arrest warrants in a little over a year. And then those cases kept going until today. I have now won. So Rodrigo Duterte is gone. This is the president who was the first social media president elected with Facebook's help. But he was just arrested last March on an ICC arrest warrant for crimes against humanity. And he is in prison in The Hague. And me, well, look, I still have to ask permission from the Philippine Supreme Court for approval to travel. I still have 2 of the 10 criminal cases left, but we've won 8, you know, and my president who tried to jail me is in jail waiting trial.
And how does it feel to know that he is in jail and you are still free? And do you reflect on the role that you may or may not have played in that?
We kept doing our jobs, which is, you know, our investigative reports, chronicling, putting faces to the countless people who have died in a brutal drug war. This is now being used as evidence, right? Yes. One of our reporter who worked on the drug war wrote a book that became a New York Times bestseller. It's called Some People Need Killing. That's a phrase that one of the vigilantes told her. The president, like this U.S. president, makes the attack very personal. But I think what I learned is, and I'm an old-style journalist in this sense, I treated the office with respect. And I just had to have faith that doing the right thing is the right thing, that you hold on to the line, that you do not compromise. There are many, many instances. And business will lead the way. We were not the first news organization attacked. We were the third. The first was the top newspaper, the second, a top television station. The top newspaper within 2 weeks said it would sell to a friend of President Duterte. It ultimately did not, but the top broadcaster, a news group I managed for 6 years, this news group tried to negotiate with President Duterte, and they lost their license to operate. And even though Duterte is out of power, they cannot broadcast anymore.
There's still damage done to the free press, even though he is sitting in jail.
It's not even that there's still damage. It's that the damage that is done will not go away without tremendous more effort, right? So the largest broadcaster doesn't have a license, a franchise to operate today. And those licenses, those franchises were given to the friends of Duterte. It's creating an oligarchy, really. It's leading to kleptocracy. I think the two things, and this is actually very similar here, you need to look at the level of corruption, and then you need to look at the who benefits from this. You know, you look today at what's happening in America. Not many news groups covered the pausing of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is essentially the U.S. government saying, you know, in order to be competitive, go be corrupt. I mean,
you've been drawing a lot of comparisons between what happened in the Philippines.
It's just like PTSD.
You've been drawing these comparisons about what happened in the Philippines, what is happening now, it sounds, in the U.S. But I'm wondering, you know, to what extent is it really fair to compare those two countries, two very different countries?
Two very different countries, but we have a constitution that is patterned after the United States, 3 co-equal branches of government, a Bill of Rights that's exactly, almost exactly like the United States. And what happened in the Philippines, tell me if this sounds familiar, is a very strong executive that pushed it and co-opted the legislature. So he gained tremendous power, and the judiciary that ultimately in the end crumbled. Well, I can't say things like that publicly. Let's just say that's someone else's analysis. But look, if the checks and balances don't work, and what you realize is that checks and balances of institutions depend on the men and women who will carry those out. And when a president, and I can again say from the Philippines, President Duterte appointed 6,000 plus people to top positions, when they are both ignorant and arrogant and use their power to kill the checks and balances, use their power for more power, then you have nothing stopping this. And we watched our history change in front of our eyes. And like I said, it's deja vu.
Duterte was a very popular leader. What was it like battling such a popular leader when you were so often up against him?
Look, in Cambridge Analytica, the country that had the most compromised accounts was America. The country with the second most number of compromised accounts was the Philippines. The Cambridge Analytica whistleblower said that they tested tactics of mass manipulation in our country, and when it worked, they used it in yours. So popularity is manipulated. When you have a design of a platform, when it's designed for maximum profit to keep you scrolling, right? What they found out, and they have this data, when lies spread six times faster, that's an MIT study from 2018. This is on social media. So when lies spread six times faster, at least, and then in our data, we saw that if you lace it with fear, anger, and hate, it spreads virally. That's part of the reason our values are upside down. We are rewarding the worst behavior of people. So popularity, I guess what I'm saying here is I think a lot of this is manipulated.
But was he able to do what he was able to do, Duterte, because of his popularity? How did that play into his ability to control and take so much power?
He wouldn't have been able to do all of that if we didn't have a behavior modification system at his disposal.
Social media.
Yes.
You're saying.
Data is gold. Data is how we're manipulated, and data privacy with the new technology, and I'm not just talking social media AI, but also generative AI, with this new technology, data privacy is a myth. This is how control happens, and this is part of the reason, look, the technology companies have figured out how to hack our biology, to hack the way we feel, which changes the way we think, which then changes the way we act in the real world and ultimately the way we vote. So back to your question, he's really popular. Really? Really popular? Why? How? Were our fears manipulated to make it that way? Were we given false promises? Was democracy crushed in that popularity?
Based on all that, based on your experience, what do you see as the most effective ways to tackle the attack on data privacy, this onslaught of misinformation that may or may not be manipulating our feelings about our government or our leaders?
I'll step back to say what we did. We survived 6 years of Duterte. Our lawyers told me, you know, you're crazy in some of the things that we did. But I think you hold the line, right? Because the end goal here is to affect your by coming at you through taxes, through business ends. The businesses themselves and news organizations are under attack anyway. So I think the first is that when you hold the line, you get off out of the virtual world. In 2012, when Rappler was first formed, my elevator pitch getting there is we build communities of action, and the food we feed our communities is journalism. So we moved into the physical world. Mm-hmm. And what we found was that our communities are there. Fear is real. And in the Philippines, there were an average of 8 dead bodies dumped every night in Metro Manila.
Wow.
This is my reporter, right? One team going out every night, and we would just have this. It's meant to instill fear. And what we saw was that when people are afraid, the fear spreads, but so does courage. And so every time I got arrested, another arrest warrant, we'd get a spike of crowdfunding. And I was just telling my sales team who was celebrating, I was like, this is not a sustainable business model, right? But what I learned is this, right? Form these communities, number one. Number two, it's got to be laws. This is not a speech issue or a freedom of the press issue. This is a safety issue. It's like you've put poison in the water system, and you have to make sure people on these platforms have agency. And frankly, the biggest question in the world today is whether rule of law still exists, right? Whether it's in the physical world where you have, the attacks against sovereign nations, invasions. Putin? Hello. And then you have the virtual world where you have impunity happening as well.
You've said that you're feeling deja vu here in the U.S. You're teaching at Columbia right now. How would you characterize the civil society response to the changes that the Trump administration has made in its first 100 days?
Like deer in headlights, not enough. Although I would say the court system is kicking back now. And then what did we see last Friday? A judge was arrested in Milwaukee. Again, these are intimidation tactics. In How to Stand Up to a Dictator, the question I asked is a really simple one, because the tech has allowed the individual targeting. So the question there is, individually, What are you willing to sacrifice for the truth? Without facts, you can't have truth. Without truth, you can't have trust. The only government that exists without trust is a dictatorship, right? But if you don't have these three, we have no shared reality. So everything hinges on us living in the same shared reality. And I think this chilling effect is here. And in the past, I used to say in the Philippines, it was Siberia. Hello, Americans. Where are you?
Journalist Maria Ressa is the co-founder of the investigative news site Rappler, a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and the author of How to Stand Up to a Dictator. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky decided to stay in Kyiv after Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, despite all the risk. That was big news across the globe. It did not make headlines when Ukraine's chief rabbi decided to stay as well, but his decision resulted in a huge loss for his family. The rabbi's son was killed in the fight against Russia and just recently received the Ukrainian Medal of Courage. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports.
In January of 2022, about a month before Russia's full-scale invasion, Rabbi Moshe Azman recorded a video, a plea really, addressed to Russian President Vladimir Putin and other world leaders. Do everything to prevent war, he says. All the ambitions need to be set aside. I'm asking you, I'm praying for there to be peace. Azman recorded that video in Kyiv at Babi Yar, the site of one of the most horrific massacres carried out by the Nazis during the Holocaust. Azman said millions of people died in that war, so we must prevent the next one. But about a month later, Russia launched its full-scale invasion. Azman stayed in Kyiv.
My decision to stay was, I understood that every man in his life, God give the special opportunity to do something. I understood that it's a real time that I can do what I can to save people, to help people. Now I can say that I thank God that gave me opportunity to be in the right place in the right time.
Azman says that in those early days, he was working nonstop. His priority was to help evacuate people who wanted to flee the country. Soon, Azman's synagogue, the Brodsky Shul in downtown Kyiv, became a hub for humanitarian assistance and a meeting point for those looking to leave the country. Around that time, Azman became much more of a public figure in Ukraine.
Before the war, I didn't like to be famous, to be in the video, in social media, in the television. I was a quiet man.
Azman says the war changed his public image. One event in particular drove him to speak out more and post videos on social media. On March 1st, 2022, Russian missiles hit the main television and radio tower in Kyiv and also the nearby Babi Yar Holocaust Memorial Site.
They attacked Babi Yar, and it was the last drop. And I took the scroll of Torah from their ark and called Russians, because I was born in Russia, was Soviet Union in Leningrad, and my Russian is native language. I called Russian to stop the war. It was the voice of my heart.
In the video, Azman says, even in my nightmares, I never thought I would have to die from Russian shelling. He says the place where I was born, where I went to school, and where I have many friends who are now silent. Azman implored people in Russia not to believe what they're being told on TV. They're lying to you, he said. Since then, Azman says he's felt less inclined to address Russians.
Because so many tears the Russia brought to Ukraine, I by myself, Russian speaker, I tried to speak Ukrainian. It's one of my waves of support Ukrainian people, spiritual support.
The war has also brought pain and hardship to his immediate family. In July of last year, Azman's son, Anton Matityahu Samborsky, died while serving in Ukraine's armed forces. At the funeral, Rabbi Azman read from the Book of Psalms and prayed for Ukraine's victory. I asked Azman about his son's life before joining the military.
We adopted him as he was 10 and a half years old. His mother was Jewish, and father, we doesn't know who was, but his mother died. He was a very quiet child, and we decided with my wife to adopt him. He was our child, so we gave him all that we gave to our children.
His 11 other children. When the war started, Samborski didn't immediately join the military. Family life was his top priority.
He married it, and he had the first daughter was born. And in May, he called me and said the day after tomorrow, he invited to be a soldier to the army.
Samborski was drafted in May of last year, less than 2 weeks after the birth of his daughter. Osman says that Samborski was sent to the front lines in eastern Ukraine after just a few months of training.
One day he disconnected, and after this, his wife received a letter from the army that he пропал без вести.
Lost in action.
Yeah. We find out that where is him, and he was killed in a battle, and the army, 1 month, they couldn't take him out because it was battle zone. But after this, we find it and buried him.
The funeral was in September, about 2 months after Samborski was killed in action. Last week, he was posthumously awarded an Order for Courage medal for his service. At the medal award ceremony, a soldier who served with him said that on multiple occasions, Samborski provided first aid to injured soldiers while being under mortar fire. He also helped repel a Russian attack on their position. The soldier said that Samborski stood for bravery, courage, and heroism. Rabbi Osman says he will continue trying to do good deeds in his son's honor, for his memory to be a blessing for others. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Imagine for a moment that you're a billionaire who's bought a historic villa, but it is nearly impossible to get to that villa in the winter. You might be inclined to make some renovations. That's what the heir to the Porsche fortune is attempting, to the chagrin of his Austrian neighbors. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The stuff the uber-rich get up to. It all started about 5 years ago when Wolfgang Porsche bought a 17th century villa in Salzburg. It's a local landmark on top of a small mountain with gorgeous views, but the steep, twisty road up there is hard to navigate in the winter, especially in a fancy sports car. So the auto tycoon came up with a creative solution. He would blast through the limestone and build a tunnel. It would be a passageway from town to a subterranean 12-car garage under the mansion, drawing all inevitable comparisons to the Batcave.
Let's go!
The mountain is public land, but Porsche got around this by paying a $44,000 fee to the city. The mayor quietly signed off on the deal in February of last year, and it looked like all systems go. Except then, Salzburg politics took a sharp turn to the left. The ruling Conservative Party was swept out of power, and the Greens and Communist Party made big gains, driven in part by how unaffordable Salzburg is for many people. Suddenly, the extravagant Batcave plan seemed to stand for everything that's wrong with the city, famous for its black tie classical music festivals and high rents.
This project happened without much transparency.
Andreas Fachia with the Salzburg Greens says there should have been public hearings, especially since the mountain in question is a nature preserve and a dedicated green space.
The former mayor signed a contract which grants Mr. Porsche the right to build his tunnel under public ground. Legally, he was completely allowed to do so. That's completely clear. But we still think this project should have been publicly discussed.
But what really seems to rankle the locals is the double standard. You see, just recently, the city tried to add more parking spaces to an underground lot in a different one of the Salzburg Mountains. They went back and forth on it for 10 years, and it was just shut down. And at least that project would have helped local businesses. This one, says Salzburg resident Florian Harman, only helps Wolfgang Porsche.
He does it because he can, because he has the money to do it.
Harman greets the whole thing with a shrug, like lots of people in Salzburg seem to.
It's a rich guy using the law, which is there because he can. But by law, this is all totally okay. And yeah, if I were him, if I had this money, if I wouldn't try it.
The city council has one more opportunity to stop construction. Wolfgang Porsche needs a change to the city's zoning laws before he can start building the garage. That vote is slated for mid-May. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
And now for something hardcore. That's Spanish hardcore dance music, also known as street fight. There's a whole global dance scene to go with the music. In Holland and Germany, they call it Hocken or Gabber. But wherever you go, the music is the same. The World's Jerry Haddon went to a street fight dance last night in Sabadell, Spain, and he slept in before filing this report.
I meet up at midnight with Jan, Mario, Roger, and Gonzalo, four 20-somethings with close-cropped hair, wearing track pants and hoodies, dressed for street fight dancing. The deal is, I drive them to the party, they talk. But first, they take over the car radio. This DJ, Mario, tells me, pumping a fist, he's like the Michael Jackson of hardcore. It's half an hour to the dance club, where tonight is hardcore night. The event's name, This Is Not Noise. I ask the boys to start at the beginning. What exactly is hardcore anyway? For me, says Jan, hardcore is a place where I can feel relaxed and at ease with my friends and enjoy the music in the best party atmosphere in the world. Hardcore gives you a way to disconnect from the world and your daily problems, says Roger, and to connect with the music. The music. Often it starts like you might expect music would, with things like lyrics or at least a melody. Then the term hardcore makes sense. It's so loud your whole body becomes like one giant ear, your chest a subwoofer. While newbies like me are just trying to not fall down, the street fight erupts. Imagine 3,000 people all frenetically shadowboxing to the thump-thump, leaping, spinning, and kicking their feet high, Jackie Chan style. John describes this dancing as like fighting on some epic medieval battlefield, like he's Braveheart. And sometimes people do get kicked or punched by accident, but Jan says it's worth the risk. In normal discos, he says, you don't even really dance. You might shake your hips a tiny bit or move your shoulders, but here, he says, you give it your absolute all. Your all and all night. As the hours pass, the place just gets more packed. Everyone crazy with adrenaline or other substances. Some people's eyes are as wide as saucers, their movements uber human. Yeah, the guys tell me there are drugs here, just like at any nightclub. But Roger says, sobre todo en las discotecas tradicionales, cuando sales, vas a un ambiente que te tienes que disfrazar. At normal discos, you have to dress all fancy just to get in, even if it isn't your style, he says. You do it to gain access and so that others don't judge you. Here, he says, no one cares how you dress. Although there is a certain look here, lots of black, kind of goth, sometimes slinky, and sometimes a bit militant or even threatening. The guys lament that hardcore attracts more than a few skinhead neo-Nazi types, extremists drawn to the aggressive-looking dance style. Mario says they've helped give an otherwise healthy, positive scene a bad rap.
Antes, cuando empezaba a salir de hardcore, sí que lo decía. Y siempre eran malas miradas, pues no te imaginabas así.
I used to tell people when I was going to a hardcore party, he says, but they'd give me bad looks. It surprised me. I no longer talk about it, he says. I go out with my friends, I have a great time, and I don't need to justify it to anyone. I leave these guys to their great time around 4 in the morning. The street fight fun won't end until around noon, and the music will no doubt be ringing in dancers' ears for days to come. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Sabadell, Spain.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese, LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.